Okay, pod people, it's the takeaway for April 16th. Our first story, President Donald Trump has been relentlessly attacking freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar.
Extremely unpatriotic and extremely disrespectful to our country.
This behavior fits a pattern of the way society treats women of color who are in positions of leadership, and we're talking about it. Also on the show, how China is using artificial intelligence for racial profiling, plus the broader implications of a strike in Stop and Shop grocery stores across New England.
This is really about how we choose to distribute the profits and the wealth generated by the company between workers and the employer.
And the legacy of Notre Dame, what the fire in Paris means for people around the world, including you. A lot of stuff to get to, so let's get started. President Donald Trump has pushed freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar back in the headlines, this time for comments in a speech she gave at the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, last month. The president tweeted her comments out of context alongside images of the 9/11 attack, fanning the flames of growing anger towards Omar, especially from conservatives. He continued his attack last night at a KSTP interview in Minnesota.
She's been very disrespectful, frankly, to Israel. She is somebody that doesn't really understand, I think, life, real life. It's unfortunate. She's got a way about her that's very, very bad, I think, for our country. I think she's extremely unpatriotic and extremely disrespectful to our country.
Omar, along with Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, is one of the first two Muslim women to be elected to Congress ever. They are also some of the few women of color to have served in Congress. So those attacks are taking a deeper tone than the regular partisan vitriol that's characterized much of recent U.S. politics. Omar spoke about this dynamic with Stephen Colbert last week and how she doesn't always feel defended even by her own side.
It's the same that I expect. So when you have people on Fox News that question whether I'm actually American or I put America first, I expect my colleagues to also say that's not okay, like that they should, you know, that because I'm a Muslim, I'm an immigrant, I'm a refugee, that I can't have any loyalty to our country. I took an oath.
Omar's office has reported a spike in death threats against the Congresswoman since President Trump retweeted the inflammatory video. Congresswoman Tlaib responded in defense.
They do this all the time to us, especially women of color. They do that. They take our words out of context because they're afraid, because we speak truth. We speak truth to power.
But for some observers, this is just another example of women of color in positions of power being attacked and mistreated, used for political gain, sometimes even by their peers and those along the same ideological lines. Donna Edwards is with us. She represented Maryland for 10 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, and she's a contributing columnist to The Washington Post. And Andrea Benjamin is a political science professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Thank you both for your time. Donna, let's start with you. Congresswoman Edwards, you were the first Black woman to represent Maryland in Congress. Did you meet any resistance to your presence once you arrived in D.C.?
Well, I think all the time, and sometimes in really big ways and others in small ways. I think, you know, my experience in the Congress was particularly speaking out on issues of foreign policy, most specifically around Israel and Palestine, that I came under attack all the time. And that was not new. I mean, I think if you look at the history of a number of women of color, Black women in the Congress, that was true for many of them as well. And so, you know, I think when, especially on foreign policy, when you're quote, not in your box. You know, it's okay to talk about, you know, food stamps and criminal justice and issues that, quote unquote, are, you know, sort of in the wheelhouse of people of color, then that's fine. But then you start talking about foreign policy or larger domestic policy and you're not in your box. And I think there are people both within the party and outside who make sure that you know that.
Congresswoman, I want to follow up on that because I think a lot, there are many professional women of color in particular who would agree. Going back to what the president said earlier in the segment about Representative Omar, he used terms like disrespectful, unpatriotic, and essentially saying she, quote unquote, doesn't understand life. That goes beyond policy.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it's very personal. And, you know, to say that someone who came to the United States as a refugee, who suffered under, you know, difficult conditions and has made and built a life here and then run for Congress to represent her district, to say, one, that she's unpatriotic, but, you know, two, that she doesn't understand life. I think, you know, if anything, the president doesn't understand life and the lives that we lead. And I think he used the phrase our country as though somehow it's not her country, too. And I think that this characterization of women of color, of anyone who's sort of outside the norm as them and us, is something that the president does quite intentionally. And for women of color, it sticks very brutally. And I do agree with Congresswoman Omar that not many in our party have come to her defense. And we ought to, because frankly, any of us could be on the, you know, chopping block of the president or anyone else. And it's ironic that the discussion, you know, centers around this group of women of color. But you have Representative Steve King from Iowa, and he just kind of skates by. Sure, he's lost his committee positions, but he continues to say inflammatory things. And you never hear the president or others in the leadership really denounce him.
Professor Benjamin, I want to bring you in here because we know, as we've mentioned already, that there have been far and few, not just Muslim women in Congress, but women of color in Congress. And we've just heard Congresswoman Edwards describe some of those challenges. Professor, how is what we're seeing today in terms of tone, context, and tenor different from what we've seen historically? Or is it different from what we've seen historically?
I'm not sure if it's different historically. I think the context is different. Obviously, many of us were really excited to look at this incoming class of Congress people. It's the most diverse it's ever been, and yet it still looks pretty bad. So I think in that sense, you know, these numbers are going up, and so there is this feeling of change, right? And let's be clear, and let's give them the credit that's due them. They ran pretty aggressively. They already didn't follow the rules, because I know each one of these freshman women was probably told, it's too soon, it's not your time. And they said, okay. Some of them took out incumbents. Some of them are representing, you know, majority white districts. So they've already sort of challenged the status quo. And so now that they're there, right, they're working from a position of, let me try to keep the promises I made to my constituents. And so I don't expect them to change. What I think is happening is that we're just relying on old school stereotypes, right? So as former Congresswoman Edwards said, right, you know, if this were a man doing these things, they would be described as assertive, not aggressive, entrepreneurial, not being able to follow directions, right? So I think it's just this sort of strange place where stereotypes are easy to tap into, and that's what's being used, right? There's nothing about Congresswoman Omar that shows that she's not patriotic or un-American. She's seen a lot more than many of us, right? And still, she answered the call to serve in this capacity. She could have done a lot of other things, but this was the capacity that she chose to serve. It's obviously not easy. Her life is being threatened. I view that as pretty patriotic. And again, I think it's just the intersection of these stereotypes, right, that all Muslims are terrorists. And that's just not true, right? So, but it's easy to use. And that's what's happening here.
And also, Professor, I'd love to broaden this a little bit beyond Congress. I mean, it's no secret that not just our Congress is lacking in diversity, specifically when it comes to women of color, but the rest of our society in positions of leadership is also lacking that. Corporate board seats, for example, some of the highest levels and the highest jobs in this country are also really lacking in diversity. So how much of what we're talking about here applies to most, if not all, women of color in positions of power, Professor?
I think it applies pretty broadly. Obviously, I'm in a particular discipline, political science, and, you know, sometimes when I think about it, there's so few of us, right? And so when I stand in front of the classroom, students say, oh my goodness, you're my first professor that's a person of color, you're my first professor that's a woman. And so I already know that we're not represented. And again, I think there are just challenges, and these stereotypes affect, you know, women of color across all walks of life, right? Again, when we speak clearly, oh, we're aggressive, right? I mean, the stereotypes are just so easy to use that when we, you know, express dissatisfaction, oh, we're angry, right? And so I think that for most women of color that are watching this unfold at this level of the Congress, they probably have their own stories where these stereotypes have been used against them as well. So I think in a broader sense, this is not new to most women of color, especially those of us who strive to be in positions of power, but even just in our day-to-day lives. I think that this is just in general, right, that we've sort of tried to reach beyond our means and we're trying to get out of our particular lane, right?
And I'm wondering if we could even talk about how we get past this. And I think it's unfair to ask women of color to solve the problem that they haven't created, but how do we get past this, whether it's in Congress or not?
Sure. I mean, at the end of the day, it is your constituents who reelect you. So it doesn't really matter what the rest of the country thinks. So if these, you know, young women are serving their constituents, they will be reelected, and eventually seniority will put them into power. So again, this notion that they have to play the right way, I don't know that I agree with that. The other piece is, you know, I study campaigns, and one thing that people can do is they can campaign to win. Sometimes they campaign to put issues on the table, and there'll be no denying whatever happens with this class's reelection that they put issues on the table. And I think that maybe for some of them, that's good enough. So I don't know that they're thinking about it the same way that we historically have. What do I think needs to change? I mean, you know, I agree it shouldn't be on the backs of women of color, but unfortunately, we have to be willing to serve when asked. And I mean that in a lot of capacities, right? Whether it's elected office or we're willing to be the one face on the board, right? Because when you're the only one, it can be really challenging. But as Congresswoman Edwards said, I mean, sort of you have to sort of be willing to do those things really to set the tone and let other people know that this is a space for us.
Congresswoman, I want to bring you back in here because I wonder if what we're seeing today, these women are also not backing down. There isn't a sense of, you know, being intimidated by a lot of these attacks. In fact, they seem to be addressing these issues head on. In your experience, is that an effective tool for D.C., for Washington, for Congress?
Well, I think it's complicated. I mean, I was described as an aggressive legislator, and that wasn't in the positive sense. It was used as a negative. And I think it can cut against you. It can cut against you in terms of your relationship with your colleagues. I think these women are experiencing that. But you know what? It's a risk worth taking, because otherwise the alternative is just to stay in your place and be quiet. And I think what these women are saying is that they're not willing to do that, that the importance of their representation means that they are called to serve and called to speak out. And, you know, look, I ran for the U.S. Senate and I was attacked for playing quote unquote identity politics. And I used to say to people all the time, my identity is my politics, my experience as a Black woman, my experience as a person in the workplace, my experience as a single mom. These are my identities, and I should be able to use that in my politics. And I think the same is true for these particular women. And you know, the more that they stand up, the more they pave a way for other women to come and join them, because there is power in numbers. And what you can see here is, you know, the attacks are coming all ways, but they have to single out an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or an Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib. But they represent a space that's really for all of us. And, you know, I just applaud them. And every time I get a chance, whether it's on social media or on television or the radio, I always, you know, make sure that I point to their achievements and to their voices, because I think they need backup. And some of us can be part of that backup.
Donna Edwards is a congresswoman who represented Maryland for 10 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congresswoman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Andrea Benjamin is a political science professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Thanks to you, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
And are you a woman of color professional who's wanted to share your stories? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE if you feel supported, or if you don't, we'd love to hear from you. People gathered singing hymns near Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris on Monday, where the 850-year-old cathedral went up in flames. Firefighters worked through the night and have managed to preserve her iconic stone towers and the structure as a whole, but the 300-foot spire and two-thirds of the roof are lost. Across the globe, an outpouring of grief from the religious and non-religious alike. But the pain of losing a monument so deeply entrenched in France's history feels especially acute for French people the world over. And we talked to some.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Antoine.
Hello, my name is Antoine. My wife Marion is with me. We live in Auriol, in the south of France.
It saddens me. It's part of history.
It's a big part of French history.
It's the whole history of France.
My name's Adeline Cyr. I'm a French-American journalist. Yeah, and I can hardly breathe.
Bonjour, mon nom est Patrick Bautier, je suis français. Notre-Dame was a place I worshipped every single week and weekend. It's all over the news. It has preempted every other broadcast in France. And I think it's not just a Paris symbol. Notre-Dame Cathedral is a French symbol.
Whether you're Christian or not, it touches you. I'm not very religious, but for me, it's a symbol of France.
It's really a world icon now. It's almost, you know, the equivalent of the Eiffel Tower to define Paris and French culture.
It's almost like you have been violated in your own person, you know. It's part of you. It's part of who you are. It's part of your French identity.
Carol Krinsky is a professor of art and architectural history at New York University, and she joins me now in the studio. Professor, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So what was your immediate reaction when seeing the images that we saw yesterday of the cathedral on fire?
I think anyone would feel that this was a deep cultural tragedy for France, for Europe, for culture in general.
And what has the cathedral symbolized throughout history?
It has symbolized the power of the French capital, and it has symbolized the power of the Roman Catholic Church. In recent times, which are more secular overall, it has symbolized Paris, as some people have pointed out in their comments. It's just one of those things like the Eiffel Tower or some other beloved monument in Paris, your favorite restaurant perhaps, that means it's Paris.
The cathedral was restored in the 1800s. Tell us about that.
In the middle of the 19th century, the building was decrepit. It needed repair in many respects. It had been neglected since the time of the Revolution. And there was also a period in which the Middle Ages began to be glorified, perhaps in reaction to Napoleon and to secularization, perhaps for various other reasons, but in any case, people rediscovered the Middle Ages. And at that point, a restoration campaign was begun in 1844 to 1864. And during that time, two leading architects and a whole group of specialists worked on the building to repair the walls and to repair all kinds of other things, including the stained glass windows.
Also, there are lots of talk about the art that is in the cathedral. From what we understand so far, the majority of that art has been saved. Tell us a little bit about what is inside the cathedral.
There is a very famous 14th century statue of the Virgin Mary holding the infant Jesus. It's in all the art history textbooks as a standard model of early 14th century art. But most of the other art that's in the cathedral, apart from the stained glass, is actually from what we call the Baroque period, that is to say, from the 17th and 18th centuries. And so we don't have a great deal of medieval sculpture left, except on what's left of the exterior sculpture. But inside, most of the material that we have that we would consider fine art dates from the 17th and 18th centuries, and there's some 19th century additions as well.
What would it take to repair Notre Dame?
Millions of dollars and expert craftsmen. They would have to be supervised by serious experts in archaeology and in art history and people who understood thoroughly the history of the Restoration.
You said it would take millions of dollars. We know that President Emmanuel Macron and others have pledged to repair the cathedral, throwing a lot of that money towards the cathedral, including several French billionaires proved to help in the process. Is this a bit of an overreaction? I mean, the towers are still intact. The entire structure has not fallen.
One of the questions, though, is how much the structure has been damaged, because when you have vaults falling down and when you have buildings being overheated, you may have some damage to the stone structure itself. There's going to be a great deal of money spent on restoring Notre Dame, but they have to do it. It's a symbol of Paris.
You're saying it's really a part of our culture, because we do have a fascination, if you will, with French culture and British culture in this country. But I often think about if something else had been, you know, if other monuments or culturally significant landmarks had gone up in flames, would we be talking about them the way we are about this one?
I think not, simply because this is an icon of a famous city that has meant a lot to American culture. Benjamin Franklin went to Paris. I mean, Thomas Jefferson knew France and was concerned with it. It goes back, an affiliation with France goes back to early days of our country, and it has continued.
Carol Krinsky is a professor of art and architectural history at New York University. Professor Krinsky, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have been here.
My name is Laura Jean, and I'm calling from Martinez, California. It's an incredible and visceral experience to stand inside Notre Dame and witness the hundreds of years of history and experiences that exist inside of those walls.
Notre Dame has been a huge part of my life growing up. Every single trip, my mother, when she lived there, visited it. My husband used to live near there when he lived in Paris, and it feels like a family member.
The Chinese government has been targeting the Uyghur minority group in the country for years. Here on the show, we brought you stories behind the 1 million Uyghurs, who are largely Muslim, currently being detained in Western China. Many of them are living under constant surveillance. But new reporting from the New York Times has revealed that authorities are also keeping track of Uyghurs with artificial intelligence. Experts say this is the first known instance of a government using AI to racially profile an ethnic minority. And the practice could have major implications for countries around the world, including here at home. Paul Mosier is a correspondent for the New York Times based in Shanghai. He broke the story, and he's here now in studio with me. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how widely are the surveillance cameras being used in China, and what exactly are the Chinese doing?
Right. So why don't we start with what they're doing, which is we've reviewed police databases that show that effectively when a camera sees somebody in China in a lot of places, what it's doing is it might look to see if you're wearing glasses or a mask. But then there's a separate function alongside it that says, is this person or isn't this person a Uyghur? And there's no other ethnic information that it's looking for at all. It's only looking for this one group. So it's kind of instantly trying to track whether a person belongs to one ethnic group and none others.
Now, tell me a little bit about what are the criteria that the technology uses to determine if someone is a Uyghur?
Right. That's a great question. And it's actually hard because with AI, a lot of this stuff ends up black boxed. So we don't actually necessarily know what an algorithm would be doing to do it. But what you would do is you would feed a bunch of images, probably thousands and thousands of images, labeled either Uyghur or non-Uyghur, and then allow the system to build up its own ways of telling whether somebody is or isn't a Uyghur. And then you'd be sort of improving it over time by telling it whether it's right or wrong in real life. And so that's what's going on. So they've created this function. I mean, it could be everything from, you know, tiny measurements about nose size to, you know, width between the eyes to skin color. All of this is probably in there, but we wouldn't even necessarily understand how it's working per se.
Where did the technology come from and who developed it? And I'm going to take a guess and say it wasn't developed with the intent of racial profiling.
It's not clear what the intent was. It comes from these sort of new generation of Chinese startups. Each of them are worth more than $1 billion. There's four of them. And they've kind of been touted as the next generation in Chinese technology. And, you know, what they did is they've made all kinds of different AI and surveillance stuff, you know, facial recognition products. Some just, you know, fix up your face if you take a selfie. Others do a lot more like this. But they are selling this explicitly to police who are asking for, you know, systems that will racially target Uyghurs. I mean, in the sort of procurement documents, they say and they spell out, we want something that can tell us facial attributes of Uyghurs or determine whether or not a Uyghur is walking by, that kind of thing. So it's very intentional. And the crazy thing about China is it's so opaque that this technology has been around probably about 2 years. It's been going into the policing systems, and we just noticed it recently, and nobody had really seen it yet. So it's already spread to about 15 provinces across China. So it's already, you know, in widespread use, and we, you know, we just sort of realized that it was being used in this way the other day. So it's pretty remarkable.
How does this facial recognition technology pair with the other surveillance that the Chinese government is conducting on Uyghurs?
So in Xinjiang, it's kind of a different thing because they can they feel like they can push the people harder in a way. There's, you know, just fewer freedoms there. Chinese people on the East Coast have a higher level, a higher sort of standard for how they'd be able to live their lives. So it would be harder for police to stop everybody every 300 yards and check their IDs. Whereas in Xinjiang, that's what's happening. There are checkpoints every couple hundred yards. You know, if somebody gets sort of testy with the police, they can pull them in very quickly. Whereas, you know, in Shanghai, if an auntie got really upset at the police, it probably wouldn't escalate in the same way. So you see different standards in Xinjiang compared to the rest of China. And that means in Xinjiang, they can be much more brute force about it. So at these checkpoints, they'll scan an ID, they'll take a picture of somebody's face, you know, they'll force them to, you know, just sort of show who they are in a more meaningful way. And the idea is, you know, with a surveillance state, if you can be more passive about it, if you can kind of very quietly measure what people are doing without disrupting their day-to-day life, you can allow an economy to persist. You can allow people to kind of go about their business, but also have this information. In Xinjiang, the sort of intervention of the state has crushed the economy and just altered the way, fundamentally, the way day-to-day life is lived. Stores are shut down. People live in complete fear. And I think what the sort of dot this connects is to be able to do a lot of that information collection and tracking without sort of crushing the economy and without sort of intimidating people in quite the same way, but, you know, still kind of having that information. So it's a kind of scary thing, but at the same time, it is sort of, it makes sense if you're sort of in the long term looking at a way to make this a sustainable way to track an entire population.
Paul, we here in the United States have similar technologies. A lot of our own technology companies have created things like facial recognition software, et cetera, et cetera. I'm thinking about the technologies like predictive policing that a lot of police departments here use, facial recognition, body cameras. So here in the United States, we're not so far off using technology in policing. My question to you is, how far off are we from connecting the pipes, if you will, in a way that China is doing in using its artificial intelligence?
Yeah, and it should be said that the Chinese police were inspired by America and the UK in a lot of cases. A lot of the ideas of predictive policing, the use of body cameras, the use of biometrics, all comes out of the United States, and the Chinese police kind of pick that up and then take it with a certain zeal down this very dark kind of road. You know, the US could do this tomorrow if they wanted. The technology is all there, and I think that the thing that people don't really maybe fully realize is that the U.S. does have quite a few more protections than China, where there's basically none, you know, and you can't even really find out what the authorities are doing. And there is a real debate happening right now, you know, in the U.S. government, surprisingly enough, and elsewhere, about how the use of this technology, how privacy should work, how data collection should work. And so the best way to kind of keep this from happening and make sure that it happens in a responsible way is to demand transparency about it. In a lot of places in America, we don't actually know how some of this stuff is being used. You know, the police haven't been particularly forthcoming. A lot of branches of the U.S. government aren't really willing to talk about it. And so I feel like, and we don't really have laws kind of governing it in the United States. So the really important thing here from an American perspective is to look at China, but also to realize that that is one possible future. The technology is already there, but what the U.S. has is a bunch of standards and principles that you want this technology to sort of abide by, and you need to kind of be vocal about sort of making that happen.
Well, we hope the ethics are there as well. I've been speaking with New York Times correspondent Paul Mosier. Thanks for your reporting, Paul.
Yeah, thanks so much.
More than 30,000 grocery store workers in New England have gone on strike. The union employees of Stop and Shop walked out last Thursday, leaving 240 stores understaffed and some closed altogether. This work stoppage comes at a moment of increased union activism across the United States, like the high-profile teacher strikes in Los Angeles and Denver, and is the largest private sector strike in at least 3 years. Stop and Shop workers have also picked up the support of local and national politicians, including presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren.
Message to Stop and Shop is to be fair. What workers are asking for is fair wages, health care benefits, and a decent chance at a retirement.
Joining me to discuss is Jennifer Klein, a professor of history at Yale University, focusing on labor. Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me to discuss this.
So you live in Connecticut, which is one of the three states where Stop and Shop employees are on strike. How big of a presence is Stop and Shop where you live, and how's it working out for you all?
Stop and Shop is the major grocery chain in my area of New Haven. The stores have had to either close, as you mentioned, or they have cut hours dramatically. And we have seen a lot of local support for the workers. And so I think that actually we're really seeing the visible impact of what happens when workers who we depend on realize that they need to withdraw their labor in order to get the company to truly recognize their demands and the value of their labor.
Remind us what some of the sticking points were that led to this strike between Stop and Shop and the workers.
I think, first of all, a significant issue is back to the question of health care and pensions. And, you know, as long as we continue to rely on employment and private insurance to enable people to have access to health care, this is going to really be a major contest in terms of making health care affordable. Secondly, what we see is the strategy of employers trying to hire new people at a lesser level of compensation, lesser health insurance, and less in terms of retirement pay, and setting up a two-tier workforce and unequal opportunities as people newly come into this workforce. Third, I think, is the major issue of automation. We've been told that, well, as manufacturing declines and there have been fewer jobs in manufacturing, it's okay because really the service sector has picked up those jobs. But now we are seeing a rapid automation happening in the service sector.
So Stop and Shop's president is saying that the changes proposed by the union could mean higher prices for consumers. Jennifer, is this really a zero-sum game where if employees get raises, consumers have to pay more?
No, I don't think it is. First of all, this is an immensely profitable company. So this is really about how we choose to distribute the profits and the wealth generated by the company between workers and the employer. Also, if this is the largest or one of the largest chains in New England, then the fact is that they set the market. They set the wage. So if, in fact, workers were able to maintain high wages and decent benefits at a company like this, then that means that other supermarkets in these areas would also have to match that.
Jennifer, I want to get back to that point about how we're seeing more use of striking as a tool for labor in recent years. I mean, I mentioned self-checkout earlier and automation earlier, particularly when it comes to retail jobs. More and more, I see automation at retail. So being forced as a consumer, essentially, to check myself out of different stores. Are employers getting cheeky when it comes to their need for their employees because of this automation? Are they thinking, well, we're really not going to need you guys after all because we've got machines to do that?
I certainly think that is what the intention is. And we have to remember that there are always innovations in technology happening, but there are social and political choices made about how technology is applied and where technology is applied. There's never anything inevitable about it. And so I think where you have a union and when workers go on strike in a context such as this, they're also asking for workers to have some input in how this technology is applied. This is why workers find the need to act collectively, because that is the only way in which they can have significant leverage with the employer to make decisions about whether people will in fact continue to be employed.
And do they are they losing that leverage?
Actually, I think we're seeing a tremendous reversal at this moment. We had seen a significant hesitance and resistance and even fear to using the strike weapon, really for fear that it would just be a losing gamble. People would be fired. They would not be able to get back into their jobs. They would have to take losses. But now, really, with the strike waves of the last year, I think this Stop and Shop strike is not taking place in a social vacuum. It really has public attention. It has the support of elected officials. It has the support of other unions. I also think that because this company has a European owner, that this opens up the possibility of having transnational support, because in Belgium, these workers are a lot higher paid and they usually are unionized. And so when the company is a European-based company, it often enables a successful transnational solidarity to turn this into a winning action. And so I think what we see is not just low-paid workers saying we've had enough of poverty wages, or workers saying it's time to really defend our gains in terms of pensions and health care, but also once again saying that we should have the rights of freedom of speech, freedom of association, and equal voice in the workplace. And I think it's really part of a significant move that we're seeing certainly in the public sector over the last year, and now Marriott strikers in the early part of this year, and now with the grocery store workers. So this is the largest amount of strike activity that has occurred in the United States since the mid-1980s.
Jennifer Klein is a professor of history at Yale University, focusing on labor. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
The Takeaway reached out to Stop and Shop about the strike, and in response, they sent us a comment detailing the company's healthcare proposals for its workers. You can read that response online at thetakeaway.org. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.